Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. If you've been with us for the past few days, you know that for a six-episode stretch here, we are not doing our typical good, bad, and crazy martinis. Instead, for the final six episodes of 2017, we are handing out our very special Three Martini Lunch awards for 2017. Think of them as crystal martini glasses, maybe with a crystal olive hanging off the side. Our topics for today, Jim: best political idea, worst political idea, and the boldest political tactic. So without any further ado, what is your selection for the best political idea of 2017?
Well, I don't know if this counts as pure politics, but I think it was an enormously consequential idea. When Jody Kantor and other reporters at the New York Times said, hey, you know, what's with these stories about Harvey Weinstein? Let's look into that, because that was, I believe, what got the ball rolling on Me Too. Far-reaching effects in the political world. It started as an entertainment story, but the sheer scale of, in many cases, just flat-out abominable behavior and sexual harassment, I think, is something we're, you know, it definitely dominated the news for the last couple of months of 2017. And I think it's going to dominate the news coming into 2018. And you're still seeing figures come forward, have accusations, in some cases resign, in some cases step away from all that. I think it is generally a very good movement and long overdue reckoning in American culture. Now, we have various concerns about whether this is going to be turned into a witch hunt, or whether, you know, relatively innocuous or not terribly harmful behavior is going to end up demonized because of this. But I think by and large, what we're seeing, most of what we've heard are stories like Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose, Louis C.K., Al Franken, the revelations about Roy Moore. These are all basically cases in which it's pretty clear this is beyond the realm of any normal innocent flirtation or innocuous behavior or even a gray area. So I think that is the decision to look into much rumored but never quite confirmed stories by the New York Times represents the best and I think one of the most consequential ideas of 2017.
Very good selection. Obviously, over the past 3 months or so of 2017, that story has dominated our political landscape and our cultural landscape in many different ways. Perhaps an honorable mention, hat tip to the Pence rule. That doesn't seem like a terrible idea these days, only having dinner one-on-one with a woman if it's your wife, or behind closed doors and so forth. Not my choice, however. On the political side, there's a lot of promises that President Trump made during the 2016 campaign, and sometimes the various campaign appearances sometimes seem to contradict each other. But once it became time to actually govern, President Trump had a lot of voices in his ear on both sides of a lot of key issues, one of which was what to do about the Paris Climate Accords. There were a lot of folks in his orbit that didn't want him to touch it, including his own daughter, including his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, including Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and perhaps others in the cabinet. The voices in his other ear were fewer, but as we mentioned with the most underrated person of the year, Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, the most persuasive. And perhaps Trump ultimately defaulted to the promise that he made on the campaign trail. And so late spring, early summer, President Trump announced in the Rose Garden that he's making good on that promise, that the U.S. will, in fact, withdraw from the Paris Climate Treaty. The way the whole thing's structured is it doesn't officially happen until late in 2020. So some folks are looking for ways to expedite that a little bit faster. And it's not only good, Jim, because he fulfilled a campaign promise, but basically because the Paris Climate Deal was essentially arranged in a way that the U.S. shells out a lot of money because we're an advanced economic and manufacturing society. And so we're a giant cash pit that's just funneling money to other parts of the world in a massive income and wealth redistribution scheme on a global scale. So the sooner we get out of that, the better. And the president set us on the right track.
That is a good selection there, Greg. I don't know about you. Did it feel like there were a lot more good options for the worst idea of 2017 than there were for the good idea, the best idea of 2017?
Yeah, kind of like yesterday, too, with the political theater. It's been one of those years. So with a lot of worthy choices, what did you go for worst idea of 2017?
I would just point out, yes, it was a rebuilding year for best ideas. But the good news is Best Idea gets the early draft choice next year. So it should balance out eventually. A lot of great options for the Worst Idea of 2017, Greg. But you know what I'm going with? I'm going with nominating Roy Moore to run for Senate in Alabama. Way to go, Republican primary voters. Way to go. This is the kind of judgment we've come to expect from Nevada. Okay, that's the harshest criticism I can think of for this. Look, even before the dynamite bombshell Washington Post report, I know there are still some people who say, look, well, Roy Moore denied the whole thing. Look, let's keep in mind, right? I mean, Roy Moore in that first interview with Sean Hannity, where Sean Hannity is not trying to kneecap him, but he asks him some very basic questions that you'd think Roy Moore would be prepared to answer. Like, say, did you date any teenagers when you were in your 30s? And Roy Moore's initial answer was, I don't remember, right? Which is not the flat blanket denial you'd like to hear. And then he said, well, I don't remember. I think I remember meeting the parents. I think I remember they were nice girls, but I never did anything inappropriate. You know, an extraordinarily unconvincing initial set of quasi denials and, let's just say, convenient memory lapses there. But even beyond that, look, this guy is a verbal time bomb, incapable of going for very long without embarrassing himself or saying something extraordinarily controversial. And emphasize extraordinarily controversial even amongst Republicans and even amongst Alabama Republicans. Look, this is a state where Republicans usually win Senate races by 65 to 35, something in that neighborhood. Jeff Sessions did not have a challenger, right? Some years, the Alabama Democrats don't even bother. And let's not kid ourselves. Doug Jones was not a whirling dervish of raw political charisma. And the common joke in the days after that late race was, look, any other Alabama Republican could have won and kept that seat in Republican hands. Most people who are you know, with any bit of self-awareness would recognize that they were endangering the Senate seat. They were endangering the values they claimed to hold dear and would have resigned and allowed some sort of more competitive candidate to take his place. Roy Moore was unwilling to do that. And then, of course, like the cherry on top was the refusal to concede both the night of the election and then further on, insisting there was some sort of, oh, if there's a hillion jillion military ballots and they voted, you know, 99-1 in favor of Roy Moore. No, you know, we're dealing with crazy people. And I don't think Roy Moore's mind works the way it's supposed to work. I can show you with math how you could not win this on a recount and stuff like that. The margin is just too big. More and more, it seems like we have a guy who believes God wants him to win and really doesn't believe that the Alabama voters get to weigh in on this. And unfortunately, you know, he kept saying the battle is still raging. Well, no, it isn't. It ended on election night, Roy. So that's where we are. I think it was a colossal self-inflicted injury. Steve Bannon has never had particularly good judgment, but this is going to rank as one of his biggest and dumbest decisions of all time. Caused great embarrassment to the president that, look, apparently there's a reason President Trump didn't endorse him in the first round and was kind of reluctant to in the second round. This is, you know, if for all of his flaws, President Trump had enough wherewithal to get a sense that this was not something he wanted to be attached to. He did eventually endorse Roy Moore, and you see how that turned out for him. So in a year with many, many bad ideas, you know, nominating Roy Moore to run for Senate was the absolute worst.
Mm. Really torn on this one, since you took the Roy Moore angle. I had a different angle on it, but I'll just briefly mention it. I think the RNC re-endorsing Moore after they had pulled out, but they had to get back in once Trump officially endorsed him, since he controls the party. The fact that Roy Moore lost, you know, means he probably won't be as much of an albatross around the necks of Republican candidates in 2018, but Democrats will always be able to point to the RNC for getting back in the game after the allegations happen. I think that will hurt them. But my choice for this year, I take you to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Bo Bergdahl, of course, gained fame a couple of years ago, or infamy, if you would like to describe it that way, when President Obama made a deal with the Taliban to get Bo Bergdahl back in exchange for 5 high-value Taliban figures who were being held at Guantanamo Bay. And the twist on this, of course, was that Bergdahl had abandoned his unit. He had walked away from his unit, and that resulted in a number of people at least getting severely wounded trying to find him. Other accounts suggest that it was several people killed, depending on how you describe the mission they were on, whether it was specifically looking for him or, you know, they were in the area of where they believed he had last been seen. So this all gets to the point where Bo Bergdahl earlier this year pleads guilty to misbehavior before the enemy and desertion. Misbehavior is actually the more severe crime. So the expectation for his sentencing could have been anywhere from several years. I think the prosecutors were looking for something a little over 10 years. Could have been life in prison. In the end, the judge in this case says no jail time for you, Bo Bergdahl. And part of the reason why, although he didn't specifically say how much this was a factor, was because President Trump, while he was a candidate, I believe said that Bo Bergdahl ought to be executed for what he did in deserting the troops in Afghanistan. So you can blame it on the president maybe a little bit. Maybe it's a mitigating factor. But when you look at those crimes and no jail time, Jim, it sends exactly the wrong message.
That is a terrific selection there, Greg. If that is the worst idea of 2017, I predict the worst idea for 2018 will be Bergdahl's speaking tour with Chelsea Manning.
I think they'll run for Congress next year. Or they're going to wait.
A lot of Democrats would vote for that. Trade in your old congressman for a new one that's a traitor.
Very good. Very good. All right. Boldest political tactic for 2017. What do you got?
It was kind of challenging to find bold political tactics that worked in 2017. But I thought about it and I realized that President Trump, towards the end of the year, he had promised, I'm going to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. President George W. Bush had promised this. President Bill Clinton had promised this. Obama, to his credit, never really quite came out and promised it, although one of his early speeches he did say, you know, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and the eternal undivided capital. And so somebody said, so are we going to move the embassy there? And Obama was like, no, we're not doing that. It'd be crazy talk, you know. We only put our embassies in the capital of every other country, not Israel. And so, look, there were a couple arguments about security and things like that. But the biggest argument, it amounted to, if you do this, it's really, really going to upset the Palestinians and then you'll never get a peace deal. And either out of instinct or out of determination to keep a political promise or out of the desire to get good headlines or as the Israeli ambassador, Oren, had pitched it to the president, apparently in a meeting, he'd said, look, if you want to be remembered as a historic president, this is what you need to do. Trump cited, you know what, I'm going to do this. And the interesting thing is, like, oh, people say, oh, you're derailing the peace process. And it's fair to ask, what peace process? I've long contended that you can get Israeli and Palestinian leaders in a room and get them to agree to something on paper. But unless you've got the Israeli people and the Palestinian people, and let's face it, the real problem is on the side of the Palestinian people, you're never going to have actual peace because there's always somebody who can fire rockets. There's always somebody who can do the foolish idea of throwing rocks at an Israeli soldier with a gun. The Israeli soldier will fire back, and all of a sudden that slain Palestinian is being touted as a martyr and a hero. It's really kind of fair to point out that, look, if you look at who's running the Gaza Strip, it's Hamas. And it's not like Hamas took it over with guns, although some might argue, but really they won an election in 2007. And then they won it again in 2014. And then they won it again in 2016, right? When you're voting for Hamas repeatedly, you're not serious about peace. There is no real peace process to derail. And so the idea of, like, oh, if we're just nice enough to the Palestinians, look, they had a fantastic offer on the table back in the Bill Clinton years, and Yasser Arafat didn't take it. He could not put down the gun. And he had to continue to be a military leader. I made one earlier in this process. We talked about Martin McGuinness and the difficulty of this and why people who can do it should be considered heroes. Yasser Arafat is the flip side of that. You know, it's not like the Palestinians were going to get a president who's going to be tougher on the Israelis than Barack Obama, right? You're not going to get a scenario in which America is willing to put more pressure on that. They never really put any serious peace deals on the table during that time. They always continue, way far too many Palestinians believe that someday we will push the Jews into the sea. Israel will be wiped off the map. Iran will help us and we will take over. Yay. And it's never going to happen. And President Trump basically said, guys, you've got to wake up and smell the coffee. You've got to deal with political reality. Israel is not going to go anywhere. Jerusalem is going to be its capital. We can negotiate East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, you know, who gets what building and what street or something like that. But you're never getting the whole city. You're never going to get all those the Western Wall and all these other ones you've talked about blowing up and things like that. You're not serious about peace, and we're not going to stop. We're not going to keep pretending that you're serious about peace. It was a bold move by the president, and I think ultimately the right move by the president, and sort of a splash of cold water on the faces of a lot of American foreign policy experts who believed in this mythical peace process that had been going nowhere for the better part of two, maybe you could say three or four decades.
Jim, that is an excellent choice, and it's such an excellent choice that it was also my first choice. So I just want to point that out, that obviously, given all the talk from all these presidents over the past couple of decades, President Trump actually getting that done. And I think the kind of the muted reaction, you know, everybody was saying, oh, we're headed towards another intifada, and there were a couple days of protests with probably more media than protesters, and then eventually everybody went home. So the fact that prediction fizzled is also a good sign that the president is, like he said, speaking reality. All he's doing is acknowledging reality that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. So there are a couple other areas it could have gone here. Hat tip to the Republicans for doing what they needed to do to get Neil Gorsuch an up or down vote to get on the Supreme Court. But for my boldest tactic, and I'm not even sure technically how bold it is, perhaps it's just more, you know, intelligent, is staying in the Middle East, and how quickly, at least in terms of wiping ISIS, the state, off the map, the United States was this year. And it didn't take a lot of great strategic genius, as far as we know. We greatly ramped up the air power compared to what the Obama administration was willing to do because they were so concerned about civilian casualties on the ground. And from what I can tell, the ramped up airstrikes didn't take out many civilians at all. And then the U.S. Helped to coordinate with the Kurdish forces and with the Iraqi forces. Unfortunately, there were some Iranian militias mixed in there as well. But it didn't take it took less than a year to get ISIS out of Mosul. It was ugly street fighting, but they were defeated. And then the push all the way back to Raqqa in Syria, and then Raqqa fell, and ISIS as a state, as a caliphate, to hold up to the rest of the world that this is some sort of inevitable swath that's going to go from the Mediterranean all the way deep into to East Asia or something, whatever their ultimate goal was, that has essentially been decimated. Yes, they still have pockets in Libya and probably still in Syria in some extent, and maybe even Afghanistan and that sort of thing. But compared to what they were, when we're talking about beheadings and sweeping down through the Anbar province just about 2 or 3 years ago, the pushback this year and the destruction of the state of ISIS, or at least that's what they wanted to be known as, was really remarkable. Hats off to Trump for letting the generals and Secretary Mattis and whoever else was coordinating all this to get the job done, and they got it done well.
That is a great selection, Greg, and let's just say it may return to our list of awards later in the week.
I did consider it for another category as well, so I'll be curious to see which one you might nominate that for. So, Jim, that sums up our three prestigious awards for the day. Everyone enjoy your awards, and who knows who's going to get them tomorrow. So stay tuned for that. Jim, talk to you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.